called koans. And koans are like ancient stories. Most of the koans that we have come from ancient China, because that's where Zen tradition developed. It's a Mahayana tradition, and it developed in China and then went to Japan. So some koans come from Japanese teachers, but most come from Chinese teachers. And this is one, this story for today is case 14 in Mumonkan. It's called Nansen Cuts the Cat in Two. Nansen Osho saw monks of the western and eastern halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one, none of the students, could answer, and Nansen, the great Nansen, cut a cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned, and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. Nansen said, "If you had been there, you would have saved the cat." Pretty wild, huh? And then there is a comment on this wild story by the author, the person who compiled this collection. His name is Mumon. He says, "Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason. If not, danger." Mumon's verse, "Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life." So this is a very wild koan, and I will say more about it. But before we went into the koan or even describe how koans are supposed to function as these amazing wild tools for opening up our consciousness, I wanted to go back to how it felt when we were meditating by the river. And, you know, last night I was talking about, to me and everyone who has been here for a while, this land seems transformative. And I said that it feels transformative because it feels like it can hold everything I have to offer. Yeah? And so we did this thing, you know, I hope it didn't feel too weird. At the end, I asked all of you, think about something that feels like a burden, feels like an imperfection, or maybe it's just pure darn grief, right? Unending grief. We're carrying some trauma in us. And offer it to the river. Yeah? And I'm sorry if my closing eyes feels weird. It's something I have inherited from my teacher. It's not being antisocial. It's just how I tap into, you know, what needs to come out in this moment. You know, I'm not thinking consciously exactly what I need to say. I have very loose threads, you know, sort of like cobwebs, and I'm, you know, subconsciously guided, being guided through it. So sometimes I close my eyes, I open, but it's not antisocial. So anyway, the land, and especially the river, to me has been, however much time I have spent on this, in this center since we bought it on June 15th, it's just been so transformative because I feel so held here. Every time I come here, there is one or the other human concern, right? Inevitably so, right? We always have some concern. Health, relationships, jobs, career, climate, fracking, our president, our lovely president and his lovely administration, all of the above. And together with meditation, together with seated meditation, when I kind of, you know, go close to the river and just allow myself, that's a crucial word, allow myself to be held by this space, I feel like I can let go. It's like someone else is holding it for me. I can let go. I don't know if any of you had anywhere close to that experience, but they say that, you know, meditation doesn't change our fears and anxieties and what we feel angry about, doesn't take away our trauma. What it does is, those conditions always exist. What it does is, instead of, it's like all of that trauma and grief and anger and anxiety being held in a small bowl, right? It just places all of that in a bigger bowl, right? So it's like the endless space, the wide-ranging mountains and peaks and valleys and rivers are holding it for us. So what meditation does is it just gives context to our human condition. And for me, this has been magically true here. You know, it might not happen on the first morning. Maybe people who've been here since last night are probably just in a shock state if you haven't been meditating for a while. You know, it's just a lot of sitting hour after hour and feeling tired, and we have not yet fully allowed ourselves as individuals or as a group to sort of let go, you know, allow this place to hold us. But sooner or later, this ecosystem, its vastness and its beauty, just vastness is the word that's coming back to me again and again. It just holds whatever we allow to come up. And that's a crucial part. I mean, especially over a weekend retreat where we cannot really go too deep. I strongly believe that, you know, if someone is really deeply practiced, they practice every day, do long meditations over the weekend once a month or twice a month, whatever, you know, they can probably enter deep states of mind relatively quickly on a retreat. But for most of us, it takes 2 days of sort of climbing the mountain, right? Before it's like you let go. You can sort of abide in the space, abide in the depths, the deep consciousness, deeper layers of our consciousness, or the land, right? So if what I'm describing is not resonating with you, that's okay. That's partly expected. But I guess I'm just talking about my experience. You know, I've been meditating for close to 20 years now, and I've done like maybe 60, 70 long, 5-day long, 10-day long retreats. And this land has been particularly, for me, healing and transformative because of this sort of this natural big bowl, you know, instead of my small egotistical bowl that I carry around myself and sometimes put it here and sometimes put it here. It's like I really felt held by a bigger space, and much more quickly I'm able to let go, you know, instead of when I was meditating in you know, urban buildings. So, one more thing before we go to the con. You know, I realize that a lot of us are here we've sort of come here, converged here, and that's amazing, right? People from all different backgrounds. Someone's here from Utah, right? I was saying Ohio yesterday, and Denver, Boulder, but many different traditions, many different meditation paths. And I wanted to say something about the uniqueness of Zen really uniqueness of Zen, and especially Rinzai Zen, because a lot of people haven't heard so much about it. And I wanted to speak about the spectrum of meditation practices that we usually encounter in different traditions and how Zen tradition relates to it. When we were by the river, I think we were probably, I mean, you can just show me by raise of hands, how many of you were focusing on the sound of the river? Yeah, majority of us, maybe. Okay, great. Was anyone focusing on their breath or hara? Oh, okay, great. Well, there's half and half. So there is the tremendous diversity right here. So the kind of mindfulness practice, right? And I'm going to generalize here to make a point. So if it doesn't exactly match what you've been doing, that's okay. We'll probably see where I'm going with this. In general, the mindfulness practice, the insight meditation tradition that a lot of us are exposed to in Boulder, it's like this moment, the coolness of this bell, metallic bell, and this moment, the solidity and rigidity of this wooden mokugyo, yeah? And this moment, feeling of my butt on the cushion, there is a kind of open focus concentration to this, right? So you are not focused on just this solidity, right? Or the sound of this wooden thing. Not just this one thing or one sensation. It has this kind of open focus concentration. And you go from moment to moment, you're mindful of whatever comes up in your consciousness. You try to be there fully with it, but you don't fixate your concentration on one particular thing, yeah? And Zen tradition, on the opposite spectrum of it, starts with something which is very, very narrow focus. So typically in Zen tradition, Soto or Rinzai, when we go in, the initial instruction is to focus on the breath, and that to very, very narrowly in this part of the body, abdominal part, which is called hara or dantian. Yeah, hara in Japanese, dantian. And the idea is that you watch your out breath. You know, you fill up with air automatically, but when you exhale, when at the time of your out breath, you consciously push the air out. And as the air is going out, right? So we don't breathe from up here. This is also another unique aspect in that there is a lot of focus on breathing from hara. We don't breathe from up here, lungs, you know, usually it's like, no, you know, Zen teacher really watch you when you're sitting in front of them and they say, you're not breathing from your hara, right? You can tell by these subtle movements of your shoulder or of your chest where you're breathing from. And an experienced Zen teacher can tell when you are really focused here, right? So there's big focus on breathing from hara and focusing, really focusing, very fine focus on your out breath. And then a teacher would say, tell me, where does your breath with eyes go? Yeah, it's like they send you searching. And that's also one thing very in some way unique to Zen is that they don't give you answers. In Zen tradition, we don't study any sutras, right? You are sent searching for answers in the form of what we'll talk about, koans. So you focus on your out-breath, and initially, it's just very narrow focus. You are supposed to zone, a sort of block out all sounds, really block out all sensation. So very opposite of mindfulness tradition, where you are supposed to be sensitive about the sensuality of the world. You know, it's like, listen to this sound, this feeling of ant crawling on your skin. And but Zen's like, shut it all off and just focus on the edge of your out-breath, right? And you might say, well, why is this difference in how we meditate in different traditions? And the point is that Buddha, too, you know, he first taught what is called samatha, concentration. First, we learn to focus. Our lives are very distracted, right? I mean, of course, now we are in the hyperbole of distraction with all the social media and our phones pinging all the time. But even at the time of Buddha, there was just a lot of stress, if not distraction, of just making your life go smoothly in rural, very poor, resource-poor India. And his idea was that you first learn to focus. The first step is concentration. And once we have learned to focus, then you do insight meditation, which is vipassana, right? So then you go from moment to moment. So first samatha, or concentration, or in other words, narrow focus work. And then you go to this open focus. You know? Then you look at how, from the point of view of this narrow focus concentration, which takes you to hopefully a very deep place, from the vantage point of that deep place in your consciousness, then you look out, if that makes any sense. So in Zen tradition, there is just crazy amount of emphasis on this initial narrow focus. All teachers, all traditions have some or the other concentration technique, right? Even the insight meditation teachers initially usually start with breath focus, right? They might not focus on hara. They might have people focus on the nostrils or how it feels around here or just how breath feels in general. But there is always a concentration element. But people don't stay with that for too long. You know, usually you do it for a day or two, a few months maximum, and then you move on to insight, meditate, the vipassana. You know, this. Okay. But in Zen tradition, this narrow focus, students can stay there for years. And it can be, you know, it might not work for some people. Different people are suited for different kind of styles. But what it does is, it just, it's not just breath practice. The more important piece in the narrow focus tradition of Zen is what is called the Mu practice. Yeah? Mu is really like objectless meditation. And different Zen teachers or lineages deal with that in slightly different ways, but you start with breath. You always, if you are working on Mu, you always start with breath. You bring into your somatic system this initial kind of calming that is necessary before you dive into Mu. Yeah? And Mu is just, you know, I can't define it for you because it's undescribable, right? But you do manifest it in different ways. It's in some ways, it's the ultimate space that holds us all of our stories, mountains and rivers included. And it's, you could use the word maybe shunyata for it if you are used to the Theravada tradition verbiage. But just this very deep experience of mu, and its very narrow focus, is essential before Zen teachers move on to open focus koans. Koans are all about open focus. So what do I mean by that? It's, once again, from the vantage point of that narrowly focused consciousness, right, where you're very tightly focused on what I am calling mu. From that point of view, you're like a little squirrel looking out into the world. How does the sound relate to mu? How does the sight relate to mu? How does my duality of me saying this is me, Kriti, and that's you, and that, how does the subject and object, if it's all one, Buddhist teachers say it's all one, how do we become two, so to speak? So everything from the vantage point of that mu, looking out is done through what we, is done through the koan work. So now let's talk about this koan in the remaining time that we have. Nansen was a very, very important Zen teacher in China. He was alive between 748 and 834 AD, and really considered outstanding Zen teacher. He produced, they say, in Zen literature, he produced many outstanding, very enlightened students, and he himself was very enlightened. And one of the qualities, just one, it's not all of it, one quality, one shade of someone who inhabits deep mu, deep mu, is just deep compassion. I was touched this morning, if I can grab this book. We read this morning Xinjin Mei, and it has this phrase. It says, to come directly into harmony with this reality, just simply say when doubts arise, not two, not two. Nothing is separate. When nothing is separate, when nothing is really separate, right, from the, when you really inhabit that moon, nothing is separate. Duality doesn't exist. Even Mr. 45th is me. Sound, or the thing making the sound and the person hearing the sound are one, right? Not two. Nansen was such a teacher who lived in that not two, and he, one of the characteristics of that not two is deep compassion. So there is this deeply compassionate teacher who sees his students quarreling, fighting, arguing over a cat. You can imagine maybe they were fighting over, well, this cat likes this food versus, this is the treat to give this cat. Or this kitten is so cute, we want it in our dorm versus your dorm. Whatever, right? The story doesn't get into that. But what is striking is, and this is the juice of the koan, is that he held up the cat. This deeply compassionate person said, if none of you can show me your understanding of Zen, if you can show me how to inhabit not two, I will not kill this cat. Otherwise, I will kill this cat. So this was supposed to be a very compassionate, wise teacher. How could someone so compassionate talk about killing a cat? That's the koan. Koan is inherently a contradiction, a paradox. And when koans are given, teachers don't say, I am giving you this koan for this reason, right? The person who's working on the koan is supposed to inhabit and sort of be with that contradiction. It is purposely designed, it's crafted, magically crafted to sort of encourage us to think about it, right? It wants to trap us in just thinking mode. Like, what does this really mean? A highly compassionate Zen teacher like Nansen held up the cat, no one answered, and he even killed the cat, cut the cat in two. And then that evening, Joshu is another very famous teacher. He's the one who crafted the koan mu. And, you know, people have written books about the mu koan. He came back from his excursions, and Nansen told him about the incident that I held up a cat, no one could show their understanding of Zen, and I cut the cat in two. Joshua took off the sandal, placed his sandals on his head, and walked out. And Nansen said, if you had been there, you would have saved the cat. And now the question is, the question that a student who's working on the koan is supposed to answer is, why did Joshu put his sandals on his head? What a crazy wild thing to do. Yeah? One crazy wild thing is that a wise, compassionate teacher, you held up that teacher, you put that teacher on a pedestal, and that teacher killed a cat, an innocent, beautiful cat or kitten. Right? That's wild, part one. And part two, Joshu comes in and he puts sandals on his head, right? What is the meaning of Joshu putting sandals on his head? I won't tell you the answer. But the point is, something about Joshu putting sandals on his head was about not to, right? This not to that we were reciting in the morning. Some aspect of reality is captured in Joshu putting the sandals on his head. And when you go to an interview room, a classical Zen training institute or temple, you are supposed to answer this koan, respond to this conundrum, this paradox of a compassionate person killing a being, innocent being, for no reason. Or Joshu putting the sandals on his head by your own action or your own phrase. Yeah? So it's not intellectual understanding of anything. That's not accepted, right? No theoretical understanding of this is the nature of reality or this is not the nature of reality. You're supposed to act, present a phrase, or act in a way that you would have done if you were in place of Joshu. How would you demonstrate your inhabiting not to? It might sound wild or not, but that's your introduction to Zen, if this is your first time listening to a koan. So my hope is that we only have about a day left for any one of you who's staying for the whole time. And my hope is just that whatever path, whatever technique you are using, yeah, I didn't actually cover all of them. There are so many. You know, there's one technique which is a different kind of open focus in that it doesn't even go from moment to moment, right? It doesn't even go from the coolness of the bell to the rigidity or solidity of the wooden drum. It's sort of open focus in a way that you don't focus on anything at all. It's called just like abiding. And in Soto Zen tradition, a lot of Tibetan traditions, they do that kind of, it's not focus, so it's even hard to call it open focus. But even that takes a lot of concentration building at first. If people start doing that kind of open focus meditation without developing their basic stability and concentration, people think they are doing shikantaza or they are doing open focus, but the depths of their mind is really running around like a monkey mind, you know. So, but my going back to my hope is, we'll do interviews this evening, and I am here just as a representative of the river and the land, right? My hope is that we can all drop in as much as we can and offer and allow whatever we are working with, right? Let it come out without passing through our trauma. We don't access Mu, we don't access transformation, we don't access, that's my experience both with myself and with number of people that I've worked with, is that without passing through our anxiety, our sense of imperfection, our grief, our anger, we don't access that place which is not to. Well, and that's the first step. And then seeing from the vantage point of that Mu, which is even the second step, you know, that's out of, even if you somehow bypassed through your grief, and bypassing is a big shadow of Zen tradition that I can talk about another time. But even if there are people who get at sort of accessing Mu, doing koan work, there are people who can do, you know, lots of koans, but they are still somehow bypassing their own human condition, that does not produce healthy human beings. We've had a lot of scandals in Zen world, Tibetan world, because of that kind of bypassing. So my hope is that whatever technique we are using, we can allow ourselves, allow is the key word, allow whatever it is you are holding in your body, yeah? And let this land and the river and the space and the community that we are creating together, every moment we are creating a community here. I'm so moved by everyone helping, chipping in. We don't have a formal cook. We don't have a retreat manager. We are all creating this together, right? So let the community hold you. Allow whatever needs to come out. And it's okay. It's totally, totally 100% okay if you have tears in your eyes when you're sitting, or if you're feeling anger, you know. We don't want to lash out at anyone, but it's not about expressing anger. It's about allowing ourselves to see it. And when we pass through that, that's when we can enter not to and have our own unique answer to what did Joshu mean when he put the sandals on his head. So we'll end with reciting what we call four great vows, and they are on page 32. This is the Zen version of Four Noble Truths. Shujo muhan se gando, bono mujin se gandan, homo murio se gangaku butsudo, mujo se ganjo, shujo muhan se gando, bono. Kubutsudo mujo se ganjo shujo muhen Segandan homomuryo segandakubutsudo mujo seganjo shujo muhen segandu bono mujen seganna homon muryo segandakubutsudo mujo